Clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
We'll pour to the creative spirit the great Ashe out of which we all emerge. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren and their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God," or "Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more!" We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths. We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names.
Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nandi of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Kwame Ture,
John Henry Clark, John Dr. Jackson,
Muhammad.
Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name. Ashe.
Ashe.
The following is a public service announcement from the Black Reality Think Tank.
It is customary in African tradition for me to ask the elders to speak. May I speak?
Speak.
My name is Alfonso Watkins. I am a licensed clinical psychotherapist here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I have been asked to share some information pertaining to the catastrophic and pandemic situation that we are experiencing in the Black community throughout the country, as well as on the planet. The times that we are living in is very critical from a mental health perspective and as well as a spiritual perspective to tap into your relationship to your creator or to our creator and understanding that we have had or have been through many of these pandemics and catastrophic situations before. So we have the necessary coping mechanisms and survival skills to do and to survive through this. So it's important that you begin to spend more time meditating, praying, practicing some of our traditional things as it relates to our traditional religions and getting in tune with our ancestral consciousness. So those are some of the things that I would suggest that individuals need to practice and acquire to get through this process. And we are praying that those individuals who have lost loved ones during this difficult time, that the Creator and the ancestors bless you and give you the strength and the wisdom to persevere through this. And so it's important that you practice and listen to some of the many of the necessary things that the professionals, doctors are requiring that you practice to survive through this. So once again, thank you for the opportunity to speak.
That how you design those programs, and all of the programs that I attended, all of the education that I had, college, public, and otherwise, nobody ever told me that I was an African woman. Nobody ever told me what the history of African people were. Nobody ever told me that America is business, and without business you will have nothing and be nothing. And nobody ever told me how to organize business so that I would be able to develop institutions in my own community. So now the sincerity of all of the programs and all of the education has to be questioned, indicted, and convicted, because the bottom line is that America is not and has never tried to produce African adults who are functional, self-sufficient, who understand their politics, their economics, and their relationship to the world politics and the world economics.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. On Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep, and greetings, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, Dr. William Rogers. We are here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 to 9 Central, 6 to 8 Mountain, and 5 to 7 Pacific. We thank you so much for joining us and being with us here tonight. We have a very dynamic discussion lined up with a wonderful panel of community scholars and activists who very well are rooted into the topic and subject that we're going to speak on tonight. So we thank you for being here. We are a part of the TimeForAnAwakening.com radio network, which is also a part of the Black Talk Radio Network.com. And so we are here, a part of that platform, and we are presenting with you and ideas that embrace and to sort of catapult our community to an awakeness and awareness that will fight for dynamic change. So we thank you. Thank you always for your participation and your support. We have a second edition of the Black Reality Think Tank that airs on Saturday evening. It's the weekend edition of the Black Reality Think Tank. It's hosted by two wonderful young women, activists, professionals of our community, Ms. Leona Williams and Ms. LaWanda Chambers. And so they have now been practicing and have been broadcasting for 2 weeks, and they'll be approaching a third week, and we'll talk a little bit about their program on this Saturday. But we are moving forward. This network is a wonderful, dynamic platform to air and talk about concerns relating to our community and our people. We have we have several programs that are on this network that are very exciting. The Black Reality Think Tank Tuesday edition is sponsored by Motherland Media, which is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network as well, and that's hosted by Brother Oshiemi Adelabu, out of Atlanta, Georgia. And we also, on the weekend edition, is sponsored by the Sankofa Historical Society. And we are, as I said, we are really moving forward. And again, we could not have done it without all of you. Tonight, we are talking about something that is extremely dynamic. And as you consider where we are in the world today and some of the things that are going on, this fits right into our topic. We are talking about white rage and where that comes from and what that means and where that going and why is it that we need to even discuss that. So we want to deal with that tonight and kind of talk about some of the points. And even I want to kind of explain to you a little bit why I thought this was a necessary topic for today. because we are in the midst of a lot of different things. But very clearly, this is one that I felt was necessary. As always, we do our ancestral profile, where we highlight one of our ancestors, someone who shoulders that we ride upon and we stand upon, and we want to always give honor to them. As I've often said, what the great Fannie Lou Hamer said, we must always praise the bridges that brought us over. And so very clearly tonight I want to do that. And so I am going to talk about a brother who was born on February the 6th, 1898, in Moberly, Missouri. His name is Melvin Benoris Tolson. Melvin Benoris Tolson. He is known as one of the most significant African-American modernist poets of his time. In addition to Tolson's work as an educator and as a spokesman for his community, he led Langston Hughes, the great poet Langston Hughes, to declare him the most famous Negro professor in the Southwest in the mid-20th century. Although Tolson began his college career at Fisk University in the 1920s, he transferred to Lincoln University, where he completed a bachelor's degree in 1924. Shortly after graduating, he accepted a position as an English and speech instructor at Wiley College in Marshall, Texas. Tolson also served as the football coach, the play director, and the speech and debate coach. Under his direction, Wiley's speech and debate team maintained a 10-year winning streak between 1929 and 1939. In 1935, the team won a national championship over the University of Southern California. In 1930, Tolson took time away from his full-time teaching and coaching career to pursue a master's degree at Columbia University in New York City, New York. Tolson returned to his position at Wiley in 1931, but completed his master's degree from Columbia's Department of English and Comparative Literature in 1940. After interviewing significant artists of the Harlem Renaissance for his master's thesis, Tolson was inspired to write poetry, exploring the African-American urban experience. His poetry began appearing in the African-American newspapers, such as the Washington, D.C. Tribune, in the early 1930s. Tolson's first book of poetry was called Rendezvous with America, and it was published in 1944. After maintaining a very successful teaching and coaching career at Wiley, Tolson accepted a position at Langston University in Oklahoma, in 1947. During that same year, he was appointed the Poet Laureate of Liberia, which inspired his second book of poetry, which was published in 1953. It was called The Libretto for the Republic of Liberia. He was honored the Centennial of Liberia's Founding Award. In addition to this professional work, Tolson served two conservative terms as mayor of Langston, Oklahoma, from 1954 to 1960. Tolson's final poetry book was Harlem Gallery, which was published in 1965 and which helped establish him as the widely recognized modernist poet. Melvin B. Tolson died after undergoing surgery for cancer on August the 29th, 1966. In the 1970s, Tolson's poetry was displayed in an exhibit known as a Gallery of Harlem Portraits at the University of Virginia. More recently, the actor and producer Denzel Washington captured Tolson's work and his coaching of the debate team at Wiley College in a film called The Great Debaters. Melvin B. Tolson. Okay, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much. We want to get right into our conversation tonight. We want to talk about white rage, and we want to look at an idea and some things that are going on here in this country right now, contemporarily with us. As I look at the paper and I looked at the story of the brother out of Michigan, Brother Calvin, I think his name was Munderlin. He was a security guard at Family Dollar, was shot and killed by a woman, her son and her man because he had suggested they need to wear their mask. There have been many other incidents that we know of. That was the incident of Oda Benga, the brother, African brother Oda Benga, who was made, put into a circus, put into a cage, and was put on display by white Americans who were performing in the beginning years in Missouri. Then we know the story of the Hottentot Venus, of an African woman whose body and anatomy was displayed throughout America on sideshows and circuses. And eventually in her death of syphilis, her body was, her anatomy was dissected, put into jars, and put on display in the French Museum. And her name was Cyril Bartman. We know the story of Emmett Till, who was shot and hung, and all kind of things were done to him because he was thought was said to have said something to a store owner's wife. We know the story of the brother, Will Brown, who was shot, hung, and tarred and feathered because he fell in an elevator and grabbed hold of a white woman, and she accused him of sexual assault in Omaha, Nebraska. I could sit here forever for the rest of the night and give you incidents of this nature where white Americans have taken out horrendous rage against our people. And there's been a lot of our scholars that have written about this behavior. And so I think we as African people must continually question the psychiatry and the psychology of people that we live among that who would do such a thing. I would suppose that I would imagine if, and this is just to make a reference point, that if cats and dogs went to school and they had an education, that I'm sure at the cat school they would study dogology so that they could study the nature of a dog and know how to tell their kittens, when you go in the street and you see this, be careful, because this is the behavior of this particular creature. Well, that's in nature, and we know how nature often works. But what we're looking at as human beings, where we're supposed to be of a higher consciousness and have some sense of spirituality, you would not think that that type of behavior would be displayed. There have been many of our ancestors who have written about it very clearly. Even European scholars and historians have written about it. I think about a book that was written by my mentor, who was a professor at North Carolina Central University in Durham, North Carolina. His name is Dr. E.E. Thorpe. He wrote a book called The Old South, A Psychohistory. And then there was a book by a European psychiatrist who wrote a book called White Racism, A Psychohistory, also trying to explain this behavior that we see. And then there have been other books. One of our great ancestors, Dr. Bobby Wright, wrote a book called The Psychopathetic Racial Personality. It deals with the whole area of menticide and looking at what is that nature that causes someone to burn, shoot, lynch, and tar another human being. And then there was a book by another European historian and scholar. His name was Douglas Blackman, wrote a book called Slavery by Another Name. And he's looking at more of some of the modern activity that's going on. And then there's another book that we've talked about here on the Black Reality Think Tank previously called Stamped from the Beginning. And this brother attempts to go back and look at that history. And I think this is one of the very good ones for any of you who really want to look at the history, not only just the physical history, but some of the intellectual history of this behavior. He tries to highlight and focus in on that particular piece. His name, Stamped from the Beginning. And then Dr. Derrick Bell, the Harvard law professor, who is trying to look at the whole idea of slavery and racism and how do we stop it, and is it stoppable? wrote a book called Faces at the Bottom of the Well, where he very clearly lays out and identifies the fact that racism is permanent. And then a European political scientist by the name of George Fredrickson wrote a book called Black Image in the White Mind. He wrote another book called White Supremacy, a Comparative Study of American and South African History, where he looks at it as in the same manner and it being very identical to each other. So the material is there. We don't have to argue about does white rage exist. That's not the discussion. We want to find out a little bit, why does it exist, and what is it that we must understand as African people as we talk to our children. One of the most recent works that was done by a sister out of Emory University who wrote a book called White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide, and her name is Dr. Carol Anderson. And I'm going to play a little clip by her before we start our discussion, just to kind of give you an idea of what she is saying in this book. I was introduced to this book by a very good friend, Brother Quabenau Folsom, gave me a copy of the book one day. I had gone by his house. He said, "You got to read this, man. You got to read this." And I'm telling you, I was amazed at the research that what she done. She is the chairman of the Department of African American Studies at Emory, and she's done a magnificent job. And I have a clip that I want to do. She starts out of, well, she's from Missouri, and she starts out looking at the Ferguson situation. The story is an example of white rage. And I'm just going to play a very brief clip of that, and then I'm going to go right to our audience. I want to see what you got to say. What is white rage? But she kind of does define a little bit for us what that is and why it was necessary for her to, you know, to write this publication. And again, which she also addresses why we need to talk about it. Because I guess some of you, what has got to do with that? What has got to do with anything? I mean, you know, black folks commit crime too. So, you know, and they commit crime against each other. So what are we talking about here, the difference between the two and how we're doing that? And as we look at marchers who are going through the streets of America right now because they don't want the cities to shut down. They don't want safety precautions to be taken as this deadly disease wipes people out left and right. They don't feel that we should take that kind of precaution. They want to open up their beaches and their golf courses and their nightclubs, and they're willing to fight about it. They're going to the capitals with shotguns and AK-47s, they're ready to do action. What is that? What causes that mentality of somebody like that? So let's listen to just a few minutes of Dr. Anderson's piece that she does and from her book called White Rage.
First, let me just say thank you. It is so wonderful having you here today. It is wonderful being honored with the John F. Morgan Sr. Distinguished Faculty Lecturer. And it is wonderful to be at Emory. I wanted to talk about white rage. And I know it sounds crazy, but let me talk about how a black woman got to white rage. And although it looks like it began with Ferguson, actually it began in February 1999, when a black man came home from a hard day's work. And he went home, got into his apartment, and realized there was no food. You know that when you come home, you worked hard, you look in the refrigerator, and the refrigerator's looking back at you. And there's that moment where he's like, oh. But he's in New York. And you know New York, the city that never sleeps. So you know there's going to be food available. So he goes outside, he steps on his apartment, you know, the porch, and whew, a car rolls up. Four officers of the NYPD hop out, guns drawn. 41 bullets later, Amadou Diallo goes down. 19 of those bullets hit. Amadou Diallo was unarmed. He had committed no crime. There was no warrant out for his arrest. He was just a black man in the Bronx. Now, that is bad enough. But then I'm watching Ted Koppel's Nightline, and Mayor Rudy Giuliani is on. And Giuliani is just unrepentant. And Ted Koppel, as you know, is not a softball interviewer. And he is on Giuliani. He's like, Amadou, Amadou, Amadou. And Rudy's like, what? He barely says the man's name. What he does say, my policies are working. New York City is safer now than it has been in years. And he pulls out his little flip charts with the little graph showing crime going down. My policies are working. New York City is safer. And I'm thinking, it's not safer for Amadou. Safer for whom? And the policies that he's talking about, it's the broken windows policing policy. That broken windows policing policy basically hyper-polices black and brown neighborhoods, criminalizing black people, criminalizing brown people. You jaywalk, the cops are on you. Drop some litter on the ground, cops are on you. You're standing, cops are on you. You're walking, cops are on you. You are getting ready to step off the curb. Cops are on you. That hyper-policing is the policy that Mayor Rudy Giuliani said was working. And while he talked about it, he said, and my police force is the most restrained and best behaved in the United States. I'm in Kafka land right now. You know where Gregor Samsa's this big cockroach, but everybody's acting like it's normal, right? You know, because I'm thinking most restrained and best behaved don't fire 41 bullets at an unarmed man. I know something is wrong, but I don't know how to name it. And you know, we have to name things in order to be able to face them, to be able to deal with them. And so I don't know what to call this thing. And I'm just going, but as a scholar, I keep writing, I keep researching, I keep thinking, I keep teaching, I keep writing, I keep researching, I keep thinking. And then in August 2014, I'm in my home office and the TV is on. And I look up, and Ferguson is on fire. I mean, the flames are everywhere. And it didn't matter. I had the remote in my hand, and I'm flipping the channels, and it didn't matter. Let me see my left hand. It didn't matter if I'm watching MSNBC. Yeah. CNN. Or Fox. Out this door. It didn't matter. And it all said the same thing. Look at black folks burning up where they live. Did you know that black people were burning up where they lived? Black folks are burning up where they live. What is wrong with black people? Burning up where they... Who burns up where they live? Because one of the things you begin to understand is that America needs the narrative of black pathology. You know, everything would be fine if only black folks would. Right? We've heard this. And then you begin to fill in the blank. If only they would value education. If only they would not be thugs. If only they would. You fill in the blank in terms of that black pathology. Because that is absolutely necessary in the narrative of America. And so there I'm watching MSNBC, CNN, and Fox, all with the same narrative of black pathology, this black rage they're talking about. Well, I'm sitting up there, and I'm shaking my head. You know how you're shaking your head like, And then I realize I'm looking shoulder to shoulder to shoulder to shoulder. I'm shaking my head so hard. And I said, no, this is white rage. Ooh. This is white rage. I had lived in Missouri for 13 years. I saw the way that policy worked. I saw the way that policy systematically and systemically undermined African Americans' access to their citizenship rights. But as a nation, we were so focused in on the flames that we missed the kindling. That kindling. Let's talk about some of that kindling at Ferguson. Kindling. 67% of Ferguson's population is African American. In the 2013 municipal election, the black voter turnout rate was 6%. How do you turn 67% of the population into 6% of the voters? Those are numbers from Jim Crow, Alabama. You do it via a series of policies, the ways that you hold your elections, the ways that you craft your ballots. There's a whole series of tricks that you can use to change 67% into 6. Kindling. Because you begin to think about what it means if you don't believe that you even have a say in who your representatives are. Kindling. Let's talk about the schools. Michael Brown School System. Missouri rates its school systems. It accredits them on a 140-point scale. Graduation rates, matriculation rates, test scores, the whole nine yards. And you can get a total of 140 points. How many points do you think Michael Brown School System got? How many? On 140. That's a good one, Eric. Yeah. That's a good one. 20 out of 140, right? Anybody else?
10.
10. Whoa.
Read your book.
Okay, I believe that's called cheating. 10. 10. Out of 140 points for 15 years. What that means then is that the public policy leadership was very comfortable with pulling an entire generation of black children through a school system that could garner no more than 10 points, an entire generation, and then start pulling another generation through, because we're at 15 points from K through 12. Kindling. Kindling. Let's talk about the police. We know that the police are here to...
Okay. That was, again, Carol Anderson. She was given a lecture based on her book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. And she was asking the hard questions. What is this? What is this? So I'm going to go to my good friend who I know very well, can answer it right on the spot. Brother Herbie White, what is this? Brother White? Okay.
Yeah. Good evening, Brother Rogers.
Good evening.
And everyone listening. What we call white rage is the best definition for something that doesn't have a definition. It can't be defined in human terms.
Yes.
Because you have to ask the question, what are the characteristics of a human being? And when you define the characteristics of a human being, white people doesn't have any of them. So, therefore, you can't expect their behavior to have any of the characteristics of a human being. Something totally undefinable. if you look at the history of white people, if you go back to the times of Roman times, for entertainment, they went to the Colosseum to see people eaten by lions and bears.
Yep, that's right.
Men, women, and children. When I was 10 years old, when they murdered Emmett Till, and they put that picture in Jet magazine, I didn't sleep for almost a year.
Yeah, that's right.
But just seeing a picture of that, could you imagine seeing animals eating human beings, tearing them apart, tearing their flesh off? Could you imagine people in France going to see public executions and seeing people's head chopped off with a guillotine? And you would have tens of thousands of people going to see that kind of stuff. There's no explanation for that. You can't put together a psychological profile in human terms that could explain the behavior of white people. And this goes on generation after generation after generation after generation. Wherever they were, whatever the circumstances, every place that they were, every place that they went, they took that same pathological behavior with them. They're deaf people. They explain some of their fascination with vampires and making love to vampires and all that other kind of stuff. No explanation.
All right. Let me thank you so much, Brother White. I knew you would have an answer for me. I knew that. Let me go over here to my brother who has he's going to school to try to understand psychopathic behavior, and he's gotten the textbook and he's studied and he's still studying, and he has clients that sometimes face this rough behavior.
What?
And I want to see what he can feel, what he feels that this might be. Brother Alfonso, how you doing tonight?
Peace and blessings, Baba. May I speak?
Thank you. Yes, you can.
Yes,
what
yes.
What are we seeing? What are we seeing? What is this? What is this behavior?
I'm going to attempt to use the English language to articulate what we're seeing. But Baba that just spoke before me, he kind of dropped the mic on us on the conversation as it relates to being able to do this. But we have to be able to put some type of symbolism, some type of definition, some type of conceptualization of this so that we can have something to work with, so that we can get this out of us. Because part of what we are dealing with is what this European is. We have been socialized under him, and we are starting to display a lot of those psychopathic personality disorders in our behavior. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be critical for us that our ancestors, like Bobby Wright and a lot of the other ancestors that you mentioned, Baba, that we continue to further their work so that we can do the exorcist, I'm going to say, to remove this European ego out of us. Mm-hmm. So like I said, my research, once again, just takes me back to being able to articulate the abnormalities and the dysfunctionalities of this European personality and how uncivilized, how undeveloped they are. And us being able to come up with theoretical modality or some theoretical practices to help our people understand what this personality configuration is, and then how do we, once again, go through the process of getting this out of us, this European worldview, this European conceptual belief system. So the research that I'm doing, and once again, I consider myself a student of Black African developmental psychology.
Right.
So that's what we are attempting to do, to put together once again, a theoretical modality to help us understand his nature, but then also help us come up with a process to get this sickness out of us.
Yeah. Okay. That's powerful. And that's the process. Now, I know, I don't know how much, whether or not your connection with the Association of Black Psychologists and so forth is, but I know that people like Wade Nobles and some of the other brothers and sisters who, and even Amos Wilson when he was on Walking Among Us, were working on sort of some group efforts. And I know I've got somebody online now who knows about some of that work. But I'm just thinking about you as a psychologist. Do you think that that can make a difference? Are you still analyzing white behavior like that, trying to?
Well, yeah, I think we are. In this, we're doing a critical analysis of their behavior,
right.
but for the sole purpose of once again for us to come up with a theoretical modality to confront our behaviors. And help us begin to start to be able to define or come up with diagnoses out of an African paradigm. Because what we have to recognize is that the pseudosciences that the European practice are pseudosciences. They are underdeveloped sciences. So we, as the original people on the planet, have to look at and get back to understanding and practicing what our ancestors were practicing before our encounter with these Europeans, because we were able to create civilizations where we were developing individuals spiritually, psychologically, and physically.
Right.
So we have to get back to those processes, those thought processes. But our challenge is, I think, from a neurolinguistic perspective, is we still using our enemy's language and his symbolism and his phonetics to articulate or define what our reality is. So in many cases, I think that's what hinders us. So I think that's why it's so important for us to make or reconnect ourselves with our brothers and sisters from the motherland, so that we can learn some of our original tongues, so that we can start being able to create another conceptual belief system with our own language.
Right.
So exactly. I think the linguistics of this is going to be critical.
Exactly. Very good. Profound. That's exactly right. Thank you so much, my brother. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask my brother who has written a book on capturing the African mind. He's looked at that as a study. And I always like to talk about purpose. I always like to help us understand what's the purpose of having this discussion. What good does it do? So let me ask Dr. Bridges. I think I see him online. Dr. Bruce Bridges, the author of a book called Recapturing the African Mind. Dr. Bridges, is it necessary in the process of recapturing the African mind to talk about the psychopathetic behavior and attitude? Because I had one brother that text me today and said that I don't care what them crackers are doing. I don't. What are you worrying about that for? Just go on. We need to get ourselves together. Why we need to? Don't worry about what they're doing. And I specifically wrote back to protest my disagree with what he was saying. But from your perspective and you looking at the book of deprogramming, is it necessary to review this as a means of of that deprogramming process? I'm sorry.
It's definitely necessary.
Okay.
It's definitely necessary to investigate, to reevaluate, to study closely what Europeans are doing, because when we study what Europeans are doing, we can actually see what has happened to us. When we study that history, as the brother said a few minutes ago, he used a term, he was talking about he used the term eugenics. I think he mentioned eugenics, mm-hmm. and he mentioned psychological destruction. But Europeans have, he mentioned pseudoscience. They have made a science out of studying us. Mm-hmm. And he's put it absolutely right. The last brother just hung up. You can take it back to people like like Galton and Linus, right. and right. Herkel, right. and also even Johann Blumenbach, who actually was the person who classified all the human races into the five. I think Blumenbach said the Caucasian, the Mongolian, the Malayan, the Ethiopian, and the American, and they came from a school of history in Germany at the time, the Göttingen School of History. And Blumenbach also, as Anthony Browder says in his book, was the person who came up with the term Caucasian, and they. According to Blumenbach, he said that they were the most beautiful of people on the face of the earth. Mm-hmm. The most beautiful hair, the flaxen hair, they call it, and the pretty pale skin. Mm-hmm. And so everything that followed or was different from that definition of Caucasian people, meaning us, was inferior or substandard. So in order for us to understand why we think that we do, we need to go back and look at the Caucasian, because his so-called science, which, as I say it again, I repeat, his pseudoscience has made us to believe that we are an inferior people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely important that we go back and study the whole field of eugenics. And I was reading a good book the other day as we talk about what people are doing with this virus going on, a book called The White Architects of Black Education. Oh, yeah. And the book was written by a brother from Chicago at the university, not from Chicago, but worked at the university in Chicago. And he talked about how these white so-called scholars infiltrated, not physically, but their works infiltrated black colleges so that black students could come out thinking that they were subservient and to do nothing but to work for white people. And if you look at it, all of our early universities, Hampton being one, of course Tuskegee being another, Howard being another, there were universities that were training black people to really be tools and to work in the system of white people. Because the tool is something, a person using a tool, if I'm using a skill saw, if I'm using a 9/16 wrench, if I'm using a hammer, if I'm using any tool, the tool is inferior to the person using the tool. So we were tools for white people, and we were inferior to them, and they could take us to turn any screw that they couldn't turn themselves or to do what they wanted us to do. So we are the tools, and they are the people who are in control of the tool. So we, as people, were taught at Tuskegee, at Hampton, to be tools of white people, to be the carpenters, to be the brick masons, if we didn't get the so-called quote-unquote classical education, which is another story, but we were taught to be tools of white people. So, and it was done, first of all, by making us believe that we were / are inferior to them. And that belief system that we have obtained came from us learning their literature, their history, their science, every field of study shows that we are inferior. Right. If you go back into any class, as I say in my book, Recapturing African Mind, I was so upset when I was going to NCCU. When you go into any class in drama, literature, if anybody asks you the origin of any field of study that we happen to matriculate in the system, whether it's science, math, physics, drama, they always take it back to Greece. And the reason they take it back to Greece and give Greece as the erroneous roots of civilization, then it leaves everybody else out. Greece is considered to be the beginning. And we accept that because we don't know. So by making Greece and white people the originators, as the earlier caller said, of everything that we study and putting it into a systematic form in our universities and pass it down to our students and having the teachers believe it and we pass it on, then this is why we messed up as we are today, because we don't know what actually happened to us. So in order to cure any disease, even if it's a coronavirus, but even if it's a coronavirus, you have to first of all get to the root of it, find out where it came from and understand what you're dealing with, and then you can eradicate it or you can stop it.
There we go.
Once you find out, so when somebody says, why do we need to know this? If I'm a sick man, I need to know, first of all, what's making me sick. And then when I know what's making me sick, I need to find out how I can defeat whatever it is that's making me sick and come up with a cure for it and kill it. Right. And so until we kill the white Eurocentric mentality that we have, we can never cure ourselves. I hope I'm making this plain.
Very plain. Excellent.
Okay. We can never cure ourselves. And so, you know, I thought about it a whole lot. So when somebody tells you that we don't need to know anything, no, I agree with you. I would take an anti position with you on that too, Dr. Roz. I would definitely agree with you and be on your side all the way when they say, well, why you want to know what white folks are doing? Just do what we need to do. We do go ahead and do what we need to do. Yes, that's correct. But at the same time, as I said before, you got to know your enemy. If you're in, why do you think people who go to war, and that's what we're in this country, whether it's a physical war, as Bob Marley says, it may not be a war of flesh and blood, but it may be a war of spirituality or a war of mentality. But you have to strategize when you're at war. You have to devise certain tactics. You have to sometimes use diversionary tactics. You have to use everything when you're at war. And sometimes when you're at war, you do things that you wouldn't ordinarily do. And we are at war with white people. We are at war for the minds of our people. What's your program called? The Black Reality
Think Tank.
There
you go. Thank you.
Right. Time for what? Awakening. There would not need to be a Time for Awakening network if somebody wasn't asleep. So we're asleep, and it's time to be awakened. And oftentimes we start sleeping so good, like people say, oh, don't worry about that. We sleep, we relax, and we're enjoying ourselves. So we're not even interested in waking up. But in order to know what happened, I mean, in order to correct any problem that we have, which is what we're talking about on your program, you have to, first of all, know what's causing the problem, and then you can fix the problem. My water bill went up last month to about $75, and my water bill is usually $35. So in order for, when I got the bill, I said, I need to find out what's going on. So I went under the house, and I saw that there was a leak in the supply line going into my water fountain, from my line going into my water heater, and it was shooting out. The water, it was leaking. So I found out what the problem was with my water bill and why it was so high. So I had to then take my tool and go under the house and fix that leaking line and replace it. And now the water's running properly. But if I just say, okay, I'm not concerned with what's causing it, I don't care, I'm just doing what I'm doing.
Exactly.
Hey, you see what's it? I'm just trying to make, I'm quiet now, Dr. Rod.
No,
I'm just trying
good.
To make it.
This is good. This is what I knew, because I know that you carefully and skillfully in your book talked about deprogramming. And so you have to be right. You need to know what's wrong to deprogram. And then, so that's exactly.
And then and before I knew what was wrong, caused my bill to be so high. Before I knew what was wrong, before I could correct it, I had to go find out what was causing it.
Right.
And we are crazy as a people. We are out of our minds. So we need to ask the question: what is causing us to be the originators of all the science and arts in existence? Drama, math, physics, anatomy, botany, aeronautics, engineering. All of us, we're originally what's causing us now to be crazy and to be out of our mind. We need to find out what it is, and then we come up with, get some tools to go fix the water line, because the water line is leaking.
Exactly.
There's a reason that all the knife, we're not the sharpest knife in the drawer.
I got you. Well, look, I appreciate that. I thank you. You know, I always appreciate you coming on and giving your comment. I'm going to come back to you.
Let me just say this, too. I just want to mention, offer our condolences, and you'd want to hear this, too, because this is some Durham, North Carolina news. The son of Miss Austin Edmonds, whose father used to sit on your porch,
right.
You told me about Mr. Austin. The son died, so now that question, they don't know what's going to happen with the Carolina Times newspaper. He died about 2 days ago. I wanted to make that announcement, and to those who are listening, you can tell them what the Carolina Times is. But Kenny Edmonds, who's running the paper, and who I used to buy ads for when I used to have my store and I'd have a speaker or something, I'd buy ads in the Carolina Times, and he was running the paper after his mother died.
Right.
But now he died about 2 days ago. So now what's going to happen to the only black news? Newspaper in Durham is kind of in question now.
Man, you can't let that die. You can't let that paper die. That paper, what is it? What was it? What was his motto? Truth unbridled.
Unbridled.
I love it. Okay.
Mentioned that because you hadn't heard it, had you?
No, I hadn't. I hadn't heard that. Did you ever buy the book that the guy wrote on Lewis Austin?
No, you know what? I don't know. I didn't. I don't know why. I think maybe I didn't know where to get it or what. But you told me that Lewis Austin used to come sit on your porch and talk to your father, didn't you?
My father. And I sit there and listen to him. I was about 14 years old. I sit there and listen to him talking about all kinds of stuff.
and you know his wife, his daughter took over the paper when he passed.
Right. I remember that. Yeah.
And just another point.
Oh, my
point.
God.
What happened?
Go right ahead. Go right ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay, and another point too, Bill. J.A. Rogers used to come to Durham, North Carolina, and would go down to the Carolina Times. Miss Austin would oftentimes talk to me about J.A. Rogers. She'd say, come to my store, say, Dr. Bridges, I'll never forget when J.A. Rogers used to come to my office at the Carolina Times. He'd talk about black history and black history in the world and blacks in France and Germany and how, you know, we've made so much, our contributions are tremendous to civilization. But she always liked to talk about J.A. Rogers.
Right.
You never knew she met J.A. Rogers, did you?
Yeah, I know he wrote for, what was it, which one of the papers? Norfolk Journal and Guide? He wrote for...
You know what? J.A. Rogers did write for, Pittsburgh Courier.
That's what he wrote for, yeah. He wrote for
That's right. And, you know, that'd be a good program for us to do one night, black newspapers or something, wouldn't it?
I agree 100%. Yep. So,
yeah, but J.A. Rogers, but she's talking about J.A. Rogers, and as a matter of fact, See, I used to do a column in the Carolina Times called Know Thyself, and my column would be taken from my radio broadcast, like what you're doing now. I would transcribe them, and every week I'd have a different article. I did a weekly article in the Carolina Times newspaper, and she was glad to get it. She always liked things like that. But her son took over, and his name was Kenny Edmonds, and young man, too, only about maybe 6 or 7 years old, and he died about 2 days ago.
Oh, man. Thank you so much for that information, Dr. Bridges.
I figured you want that.
Yeah, I did. Thank you. We'll come back.
And I'm going to hold on if you're going to somebody. I'll just hold on a minute.
Okay, please don't go anywhere. Okay, let me go over here to, first of all, you are listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. We are here on the Time for an Awakening.com network, which is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network. This is a call-in format. We have our number here is area code 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. We would love to have your comments, or if you have a question you'd like to ask, by all means call us at that number and pose your question at any point in time. I want to hear from the sisters. I've got two sisters that I know very well online. I know one of the sisters is a part of our Saturday's program, which is the weekend edition of the Black Reality Think Tank. She's also a producer, one of the producers. And I'm going to go over here and ask her. She's also in mental health. She's a licensed psychotherapist. And maybe she can also add to this from a clinical perspective. What is this? Ms. Williams, what is white rage? Ms. Williams? Let's see, did I hold on, Ms. Williams, maybe I thought I had your number correctly, but maybe I don't. All right, I'll come back. Let me find it, and I'll come back to you. Okay, let me go to Sister Yan. Sister Yan practices Ifa. She's a student of Ifa, and it's the spiritual system of Africa, out of Nigeria. Sister Yan, what do you think in your studies of Ifa? What would they say? What is said about white rage and this behavior that we are seeing? Because I know a lot of the religious spiritual community has a theory of this. You know, the Nation of Islam has a very powerful story of who this is and who this behavior is and where it comes from. So is there anything about Ifa that you could share for our audience tonight about this behavior?
First, good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
And Dr. Rogers, thank you for doing this program. This is critical,
yes,
critical. And I loved everything. I mean, what we're talking about is very painful, and I'm going between anger and pain, but it's very critical. So I need to say that. As far as Ifa, I hadn't thought about that as I was listening. As far as I know, from what I know, I'm not hearing a lot about the behavior pathological behavior in terms of white folk. And the only thing I could say about that is that before the European invaded Africa, we didn't have these kinds of pathologies, mental pathology. We didn't have this. Mm-hmm. We had our own stuff, you know, our own dysfunction in our communities, in our African and indigenous communities, but we didn't have this, you know, what you were talking about, the murders and the rampant violence and the killings of other people, you know, just because, or just because you want what they have, that didn't exist in our communities. We didn't have the levels of mental illness,
right,
you know, the bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and all of these things that are rampant, you know, in America, that wasn't in existence. So from what I can kind of glean from talking with different Babalawos and whatnot, is that this was not common. So they didn't have to address this kind of stuff until the European invaded. And when there was, when mental illness did exist, when those issues did occur, there are spiritual rituals, there are herbs, there are things that are done to correct mental illness as in any other illness, because Ifa and African spiritual systems are primarily healing systems.
Okay.
So, yes, there are ways to heal mental illness, but it's not common.
Okay.
And this, for the African, European behaviors, was totally shocking from what I've read.
And see, I pay attention to those spiritual system definitions of those things. I think it has a lot to say, because even the Europeans got a symbol of what that means. I was reading something not too long ago. They said that in their mythology story system, they said the evilness that plagued Europe came when the devil, when the emerald that was on the forehead of the devil fell off. And when that fell off, that the evil then began to plague the world. And that emerald was that third eye idea that was there. And I'm going to finish reading it. I haven't finished reading it yet, but it's very interesting that this is from their own mythology, that this is where evil comes from.
I'm not aware. I'm still a student, so I'm not aware of that. But I, you know, what I did share is something that I have read and have been told by those that practice indigenous spiritual systems.
Right.
But I do want to make a comment, because on this insanity that we see coming from Caucasians, a few comments, because what was said has been so powerful. And Dr. Rogers, I wish that, not that I wish, I'm trying to get my thoughts together here. I believe we need to touch on this topic on a regular basis.
Okay. agree.
The reason is because black folk are in denial. Many of us, not all, but many of us are in denial about the savagery, a savage gene, a psychopathic gene, whatever it is in the European race. Many of us are in denial that that exists. And so we think we can pray their violent savagery away. We think we can rationalize it away. We think we can vote it away. We think we can moralize it. You know, these are moral issues, you know, and we can't do any of that away. We can't make it go away. And so we spend so much of our lives, you know, running away from this reality. And one thing that we can't do is deny our lying eyes. So when we, you know, you talked about some books, the one that I use with people is Without Sanctuary. You know, looking at those pictures of black men being burned, you know, before and after the fact, looking at all the torture, people can't deny their lying eyes.
Right.
But I think Bruce was alluding to this. If we don't face this thing of what's been done to us systematically and continues to happen, we'll continue to run from it and thereby continue to be ineffective in our fight. Does that make sense?
Right. That makes a lot of sense.
We have got to face these realities, and we've got to hear the reality of how it impacts us. Brother, the first brother, I think, was it Herbie White that spoke first?
Yeah, he went first, yeah. Uh-huh.
When he talked about being young with and experience being young while when Emmett Till was murdered and witnessing that, now he couldn't sleep for a year? That's what we need to hear.
Yeah.
Because, again, it's those horrible, you know, vomit inducing realities that as long as we run from it,
right,
you know, we will continue defragmented, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, and then looking at the condition of our people and all the craziness, you know, as I was talking about earlier, that we see in our, you know, in our communities, violence against each other, domestic violence and blah, 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 blah. What we are seeing is a reflection of what has happened to us.
Right. Exactly.
So when we come to understand that something happened to us, it continues to happen to us, and we must take our heads out of the sand, I really think that it's a major part of the healing process. Another thing is Dr. Alvin Poussant called some of what white rage entitlement dysfunction, in terms of how they feel that they could just kill anybody, invade anybody, rob anybody that they want.
Mm-hmm.
Any group, you know, so there have been several labels, several psychologists, et cetera, that have, you know, defined this savagery. But again, we've got to face it en masse. You know, I'm always talking about how it's important for the masses of people
right.
to understand what's going on.
Exactly.
With us.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll be back to you. I want to take a quick break and then I'm going to come back and look at something else that I think might be very important for this discussion. But let's take a quick break and come right back.
Zion and Zion, it's Africa, it's your
following is a public service announcement from the Black Reality Think Tank.
My name is Leola Williams. I am the owner of an outpatient mental health and substance abuse facility. I am a clinical substance abuse and mental health counselor. I appreciate the Black Reality Think Tank for inviting me on their program to share with you some of the things to help reduce your fear and stress during this pandemic. I know we are all experiencing fear and uncertainty at this time, not knowing who or what to trust, coming from the media or the White House, which makes it difficult to remain calm. One thing that I would strongly suggest is to reduce the amount of time you spend watching the news. Try to increase your communication with family and friends. Listen to your favorite music. Perhaps start an in-home garden with your children. Have them to plant their favorite vegetable garden. Play a word game with family and friends using the first letter of their name to create a word to describe themselves. Exercise together, make it challenging. Dance, show off your old routines. Share some of the rules from the old days that your grandparents implemented. Watch a movie together. Have a nice fun day together. Learn to breathe, relax, and take one day at a time and pray daily. These are just a few tips on how to reduce your stress.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Okay, my brothers and sisters, we are back. I just wanted to remind you once more that our weekend edition of the Black Reality Think Tank airs every Saturday evening from 3 to 5 Central, which is 4 to 6 Eastern, 2 to 4 Mountain, and 1 to 3 Pacific. So please join us. Ms. Leola Williams and Ms. LaWanda Chambers are the producers of that program, and they have a wonderful discussion coming up on domestic violence. And we are seeing an astronomical amount of cases of domestic violence during this pandemic situation. There have been several very close situations I know of where people have been, men have killed their mates during this particular time. So they want to talk about that this week, look at some ways to survive, particularly to the survivors. Previously on the Black Reality Think Tank, we had a discussion with Brother James Mosley. We were looking at brothers who were perpetrators of domestic violence, and we were talking about some of the programs and some of the things that they were doing. But anyway, they'll be on this Saturday from 3 to 5, again, here on the Black Reality Think Tank Weekend Edition. Our call-in number here is area code 215-490-9832. That's for our internet audience. If you'd like to call and raise a question or make a comment, we truly welcome you to do that. Brother Pugh, that was a book that was written. You and I have talked about it before, Stamped from the Beginning. We've discussed that in other previous discussions. Do you think that book, and I think you said you read it. I'm not sure if you have, but if you haven't, then we can just kind of go from somewhere else. But do you think he answered in that book what this behavior is that we see among white Americans?
Well, I can't recall if he got clinical. It seems like the people on this show are attempting to make some kind of clinical diagnosis of the white mind. He didn't do that, but he just pointed out that there were people who believed that blacks were inferior, and that they've been believing that from the beginning, and that there were other people who believed not that blacks were inferior, but that we were just backward. And then finally, there was a third group who believed that blacks were neither inferior nor backward. By the way, your author, Carol Anderson, the woman that you mentioned in the beginning with White Rage, her answer is that black progress generates white rage.
Okay.
And right. An easy explanation for that is that if you have a society, if you have a mentality that says the world is a game of King of the Hill, and you're concerned that some other group may be, out competing you, well, then, you'll do some different things. So.
Right, exactly. And you're right. She does make that point very clear in there. But and I think the brother that did the book, Stamped from the Beginning, he also does indicate some things as it relates to the history of it. It's just as you said, it rides on that inferiority idea.
Well, actually, you know, if you want to go back to Kendi, he talks about an African. You remember when he talks about the first African that wrote on Africa? He was the son of a diplomat who was captured by the Catholics, and he mm-hmm. became a slave to the Pope. My memory is kind of hazy, but he was the first theory of Africa comes from an African, and it was basically a theory of Africans who were attempting to invade Southern Africa. And so it was argued from the point of view that these were inferior people and whatnot. Well, that's where that kind of language comes from. But by the way, can I make one other tight point?
Were you thinking about Oladao Equiano? Is that who you're thinking about?
No, he's the first enslaved person who gave an account of his story. The
right,
person
okay.
I'm talking about was writing in the. He was writing in the 1400s.
Okay.
And you remember now the whole ideal of writing a chronicle at all. It was a Portuguese nephew or relative of the king who was writing about his exploits in Africa.
Right.
And so, but in other words, what I'm saying though is that the point that Kendi makes is that the first theory of African people comes from an African who happens to have been a captive of a Portuguese pope or whatever, a religious figure. But here's the point I'd like to make. I'm hearing a lot of talk that sounds kind of scientific, sounds kind of medical and all that. I was listening to something today that was talking about the 1918 flu pandemic. And it talked about Philadelphia versus San Francisco versus St. Louis. And what it said was that Philadelphia just ignored the pandemic, and they had, a major outbreak. By the way, he said that there were three waves of the pandemic. So Philadelphia on the first wave ignored it, and they had a major outbreak. There were major deaths and whatnot. But then the second wave after that, they began to take precautions. In the case of St. Louis, initially, they took, precautions, social distancing and wearing masks and all that kind of stuff. But then, and as a result, they had, very few deaths and whatnot. But then the problem was that they had the wrong interpretation of their results. They assumed that their good results came from wearing gauze face masks. And so as a result, they decided that they would forget about social distancing and just wear the mask. Well, mm-hmm. it turns out that they had, when the second and third waves came, they had a worse outbreak of the virus, of the flu, and more deaths than did Philadelphia. And then the final city was St. Louis, where they actually practiced social distancing and all that stuff. So the only reason I'm saying that is mm-hmm. that I'm hearing these scientific-type, medical-type analyses that seem very, very shallow, and I just want to say there are big consequences to, talking real scientific talk when you, without, any real basis. So, because it's real easy to get trapped up into what you think as opposed to what nature is really presenting to you.
So are you saying you're hearing that on the news, or are you hearing that on our program?
No, I'm hearing these people tonight make statements, categorical statements about the nature of white people and the difference between this, and not even clarifying their terms.
it's just really just basically racist, basically. And you just wonder. And in fact, the spirit of them making is that they're saying that, you know, white people were doing all these ugly things to us and causing us inferior and whatnot. And in the same breath, that's what they're doing to white people. So you just kind of wonder, you know, are they really listening to what they're saying?
So I just want to make sure I'm clear. So the two men that killed Emmett Till and beat him and threw his body in the bottom of the river, to talk about them would be racist? Is that what you're saying?
No. I'm saying that to make, for example, when Carol Anderson made the point that Rudy Giuliani, relative to Amadou Diallo right. killing, was indifferent to the death of Amadou Diallo. Well, if you go and you look at Khalid Muhammad, when he was on Phil Donahue, and Phil Donahue was asking him if he had any compassion for Cerny and Goodman, who died, you know, on the with Cheney down in Mississippi, and he had the same kind of impassive attitude that Rudy Giuliani had. In other words, that this is a matter of he was telling his truth. That, hey, you know, don't have any compassion for these people. We're at war with these people. Well, that's what Giuliani was saying. And, in fact, you could explain white behavior simply as terrorism. That if you believe, in fact, what terrorism is all about is that you want a public spectacle of your violence. That's why the Romans put people's heads on poles, is that they wanted people to fear, you know, reacting against the Romans. Well, you know, that's why you do exotic stuff. But in any case, So, all I'm saying is that if the people who, each of the people who talked tonight, if they listened to what they said and they took white people out of their conversation and put anybody else in there, they would realize just how absurd what they're saying sounds.
Oh, this is ridiculous.
Okay.
Cute.
Go ahead. You were closing that statement?
I'm done. That's it.
Okay. Brother White, Herbie White, would you like to respond to that? What Mr. Pugh said, he said that talk about, you know, white racism, so it just is this ridiculous conversation. It's really doesn't have any foundation because we're doing the same thing that we're accusing whites of doing. What was your comment on that? Brother White?
Yes, Dr. Rogers, I base my opinion on the history of what white people have done, and you can put that on next to the history of what black people have done and what white people have done and why they have done it, and the fact that they're unrepentant about what they've done.
Okay.
So if you're telling me that black people are doing the same thing white people are doing, that black people are doing what King Leopold did in the Congo or what Cecil Rhodes did in South Africa and whatnot, and say that this is the same thing. What black people are doing are reacting to the behavior of white people. If a person comes in my house and kills my whole family, how am I supposed to feel about them? How am I supposed to respond to that?
Okay.
That's my opinion and whatnot. And the idea that white people are, you know, you can rehabilitate them or you can talk to them or you can explain to them or you can work things out. You can be as nice as you want to white people. You're going to get the same reaction from them. They put history on the witness stand. And let it tell you the story. You don't have to listen to my story. You can pretend you never heard of me or I don't exist. Put history on the witness stand and let it speak for itself. And put history, and see if you can put African history next to European history and come up with the same conclusion.
I got you. Okay. Brother Oshie, is that you?
Hey, Doc, how you doing?
Fine, how you doing? How would you respond to Brother Pugh there?
Wow, Brother Pugh. You know, I think anybody who who's supposed to be conscious and aware and understanding of our history and our dilemma and our plight and so forth, understanding our, you know, how we've been treated, would certainly not side with Caucasians in terms of saying that talk that you're doing is racist. No, there's only one kind of racism, and as Europeans, we can't be racist. They created, documented. They gave human beings a stratification. So that's them. But how do we respond? That's on us. But we've been trained to respond in a certain way.
I gotta call you back, brother.
And that's on them. But it's on us to get out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, we're supposed to react the way we react. Those who really get upset and understand it and are willing to, you know, do whatever we can to organize to get out of it, as opposed to that's the way it is. Okay. You know, that's how they are.
Okay, all right.
So great. Be it.
All right, I appreciate that. 919-477.
No comment.
Okay, all right. Federal North Carolina, 910-237. Any comments?
Yes, sir. How you doing, brother?
And how you doing?
Everybody else in the audience, Brother Dane down in Fayetteville. In listening to what's been said tonight, I have a little saying that it's not who you're called. It's not how you're called. It's what you respond to. Mm-hmm. You know, you can call me anything, but it's what I respond to. And, you know, we don't have to justify where we are in the world on a European basis.
Right.
You know, they colonized our mind, so it's up to us to release our mind. That's what we've been doing, you know, if you've been in the boat. But if you look at the media now, they have a lot of programs with interracial marriages. A lot of the sisters have white husbands, and they're really promoting diversity. Which is all well and good if that's your cup of tea, but there's a reason for that. So there are a lot of things that we have to pay attention to,
right,
and deal with it.
That's right. Exactly. Thank you. Brother Lush, how you doing tonight?
Good evening, Brother Rogers and everyone on the line. I'd like to kind of turn the dial, if I may, a couple of digits to the left and to the right and back again.
Okay.
And I kind of wonder, why haven't we really dealt with murder? You know, I do recall somewhere I read where Cain slew Abel, and for some godforsaken reason, he was banished, right?
Okay.
I do recall somewhere I thought I may have read that when one brother killed another, he was literally wrapped with him. He was wrapped up with him. It was a culture. And so I use those two, and there's several others I know, but why haven't we dealt directly with murder? That red drum, you know, the murder spelled backwards. Why haven't we directly faced it and did the kinds and types of things to correct that? And I know there's a psychological and psychodynamic portions of it and what have you, but, you know, if we kill animals, we have to directly face the consequences of our actions. So how is it that we're just kind of hop, skipping, jumping over and not really looking at what one human has done to another and try to be able to create? I'm sure that there are lawyers and politicians and someone out there that has those thoughts and try to create policy for us to better face this thing we call murder or death of another individual. And so I'm just kind of curious, and then I admit I'm not as well astute as some of the callers that I've heard up to this point, but I know it's just something inside me that says and you know that I've done it, that there have to be thoughts that run through your head that there is some sort of retaliation. Maybe not directly, but there's something that I have to, that sort of eye for an eye kind of mindset. Even though we are in the land of laws. But the thing about it is that how is it that we had not, or we just refused not to look at murder straight ahead, straight on, and deal with it as it is? That's just my comment for the
evening.
Thank you.
And I think a lot of that is actually defining the taking of another human life. And I hear where you are. I hear where you're going. But the rationalization process that the human animal uses sometimes to do things like that is where the confusion, because very clear, war is murder. Whether you reach that or not, the death penalty, that's murder. Others would say it's justification. When you kill somebody, you kill too. But it's still murder. And that would require some real in-depth things about human nature. But Brother Alfonso, what have you learned about the whole concept of murder? And how does the human mind deal with the taking of another human life, regardless of what the reason is? War, criminal self-defense, you know, all of this. How is that viewed from your profession?
Like I said, I think we are having, I mean, when we're talking about philosophies, ideologies, theologies, mm-hmm. Different areas of science, and how we articulate these sciences depend on, once again, where people are in their own space. But I think there's a level of, when we have these conversations, I think people have their areas of science where that's where they study. And I think we as a collective group of people have to get to a place when one of us are speaking out of that science, those who are not in that science need to be able to respect what is being said. I don't know if you necessarily have to agree with it, but I think there has to come to a level where we can respect individuals when they're speaking from a science that's what they study. And so, because we all are supposedly supposed to be having the same intent of trying to understand how do we get ourselves out of this condition where we are fearful of challenging this European man on the reality that we are human beings. Like my brother that just spoke before me, we have to deal with the reality that these people have murdered us. And we are trying to understand why they murder us, but at the same time, we have to come up with some type of mechanisms to be able to defend ourselves from these people.
Okay.
So part of the conversation, once again, the question that you're asking me, in warfare, there is murder. We at war.
Yeah,
these people are at war with us.
Right.
And we are trying to compromise and negotiate and reason and rationalize with them and all that. But they are at war with us. There's an element of them. So we have to come up with mechanisms to defend and protect ourselves, but also as it relates to where we at in our ability to define what's happening is where we at. Because we have to realize for almost 260 years, these Europeans, these Caucasians were able to do whatever they wanted to do with us. So we coming out of a condition that no other race of people have experienced. So we trying to articulate and define that. So when my brother say that we racist, I mean, I don't understand how he can say that we racist when we have not, we still living amongst these people trying to be at peace with them,
okay,
trying to negotiate with them. But how are we racist? And then how is it that if a individual has an area of science where they're studying, it's not my opinion. I'm a student of Black African developmental psychology, so I'm a student of John Henry Clark. I'm a student of Amos Wilson,
right,
Marumba Ali, Francis Cress Welton. So I'm not speaking from my own thought process. I'm speaking from what those African scholars have put on paper, and we are continuing to move their scholarship forward into the 21st century.
Right.
So I think we have to get to a place where we all have opinions, but we need to be realistic when we are denigrating or disrespecting each other, saying what the next person is saying is ludicrous and that type of stuff. I think we have to be more mature in our intellectual discipline to exchange better than that.
Right.
That's right.
Thank you so much. I'll show you on that. I just wanted to also remind our listening audience that we had heard from Brother Oshiemi Adelabu a few minutes ago. He is the organizer of the African Perspectives that comes on every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. Eastern to 1 p.m. Eastern. And I want to just remind you, very dynamic program as well, talks about a lot of the same things that we're talking about here tonight, about the mind and where we need to be as African people. So for those of you who are listening, I suggest that you listen to him on Monday, Wednesday, or Friday from 11 to 1. And we appreciate him. I appreciate all of your comments. I don't think that even though they may differ, this is a think tank process. This is the Black Reality Think Tank, and we pose ideas to think about them to sort of energize you in your thinking process. Most of you, a lot of you who are out here listening tonight, you are agenda setters. You are out trying to set some agendas, doing work in your community, doing work around you.
Hey, Doc. Hey, Doc Rogers.
Yes.
Hey, I need to make this announcement quickly. You can go on with your program.
Could you let me finish that? Could you let me finish this one statement?
Sure. And I'll come back to you. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
So, you know, this is a think tank organization, and we would very much like for you to continue to pose your ideas. You know, we're not trying to get everybody to agree with everything, but that's the purpose of it, is to get us to think about it, to help you set your agendas and plan your ideas and your programs as you move forward. Okay, Brother Ocean.
Let me apologize to you and to your audience. Listening audience, I apologize.
That's okay.
Tomorrow, I have on tomorrow the brother who is the coordinating chair of the North American Pan-African Federalist Movement, Brother Mwalimu, and we're going to talk about where that movement is at right now, where it's moving to in terms of being ready for the big meeting in Addis Ababa next year. But there's a North American meeting in October through Zoom, originating out of here in Atlanta, you know. Mm-hmm. So the Pan-African Federalist Movement, I mean, there's a lot of things that are out there we need to jump on as one. We need unity. There's no doubt about all the things that are happening to us would not be happening to us. We're unified and establishing our own homeland.
Right.
We can't be sovereign here. Can't. This is theirs, not ours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I always said, I'd rather struggle and live in a world of my own choosing than to be a fool in somebody else's dream. This is the Americas. This is the European dream. This is the Caucasian's dream. And his dream is usually a nightmare for us.
Mm-hmm.
So,
very good.
So I hope everybody get a chance to listen. And thanks a lot, Doc. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you. Okay, Brother Timothy, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Brother Timothy, what is this white rage, man? What is this all about?
Dr. Rogers, I will first say that I'm a student of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and he always took us back to the beginning and the origin of the king in the cave. He talked about Europe bottled up in the cave. He talked about before the Aglacia period. He talked about the melanin, the pineal gland. He talked about their attitude, how they were always trying to survive. He also gave us a theory of Yaku. Now, that might be an ideology, a theory. People have theories. And some people look at it as a glorious story.
Would you mind sharing the Yaku story, just a brief synopsis of what that is? Because I did mention it earlier. Would you mind?
Sure. He said, sure. He used Yaku to say that you had the dominant and recessive gene. He saw that the unalike attract. So with that, he wanted to use it in a way of creating another race. And that race became other races out of that one race. And but that recessive gene is at the end of the race. Those people were diabolical and evil because they lacked things. Now, if you don't want to take that part, let's bring it to modern day time and say that they are people who are looking for preserving their race. If you take what they have genetically and take what we have genetically, if we are to integrate and we are to intercourse with them and have children, they won't have the color of the European. They'll be darker, you know. Mm-hmm. So at that point, their race will be eliminated off the planet. So this rage that they have of us means that a disappearing of them not being on the planet.
Yeah, that's Dr. Francis Wilson says that same thing. Yeah, you're right.
And you know what Elijah Muhammad said? He said, the scientists will bear witness. Meant Dr. Clark, meant Amos Wilson, meant all the writers, David Walker. He said, the scientists and writers will bear witness.
Right.
A man who had a second-grade education from Sandersville, Georgia, who taught a mouthpiece, Malcolm X, into eighth grade. So when the reporters went in Malcolm's face and tried to trap him into racism and speaking racism, he said, no, I'm just speaking of, like everybody said, in their position, I'm speaking of history.
Right.
Now, Dr. Rogers, if we take that from all that the Greeks and Romans did, you study all of Shakespeare's writings, all the way to the Middle Ages, all of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, all through World War One, all the way up to now. Let's, for instance, Dr. Rogers, if we take Ahmed Arbery, are you familiar with Ahmed Arbery from Georgia?
Right.
And he was shot by two people, massacred.
Uh-huh.
He was walking through Georgia as a jogger. And it's a video out. Al Sharpton, everybody's talking about it. The reason why you're not hearing about it is because of this pandemic. They've been trying to protest it. But this guy was murdered in February. And the two men who were murdered this time, they haven't been charged. They let him go. So what is it about these two white people who murdered this man? They murdered him. They massacred him with weapons like an Emmett Till. So what is it about people that they can shoot you down and kill you and get away? That's the other part of it. What brings about the rage? What's inside of them that makes them want to murder the Red Drum? So many people came before me who had different positions. All of them are good. Everybody should be listened to. But what is it about that you want to take black people off the planet? They're not successful in doing that from the very beginning, Dr. Rogers. You know it. But they keep trying. They keep trying. And Dr. Muhammad said, they have smoke fire. They have to burn themselves out. Mm-hmm. Let's take into consideration that they murder men, women, children, since they came out of the caves.
Okay.
And they're not stopping. Something. What's the science of that?
Mm-hmm.
He said the scientists will bear me witness. Well, go to the scientists then. Go to the writers then.
Yeah.
Look at their history.
All right. 414-248. Ms. Williams, is that you?
Yes. Good evening, everyone. I'm going to make my statement brief. I agreed with a lot of things that has been said. I really agree with Brother Tim in his speaking. And one of the things that I've always argued about, because my mother, you know, is a biracial. Her mother came into slavery and all of that stuff. And I know from my own experience, I can only speak about what I know and what I've seen. Had an uncle that wanted to get with a white woman in Mississippi. They had to run away because had he not left down south, he'd have been killed that night. But my whole analogy about the white race and the things that they do, I feel, and what I've witnessed, they have a problem with themselves. And like I posed a question to one of my professor in school, if you guys had a problem with color, why is it that you spend all this time in the sun trying to look like me? I am not black. I am a caramel color person. Yet you spend thousands of dollars
to go to Mexico, California, whatever, to get skin cancer just to look like me, and then that color leaves in the winter. So therefore, if the problem was about people of color, why would you want to change the way you look? And once I learned that, I began to just develop my way of thinking differently. We're not the problem. They're their own problem, because every time they look in the mirror, they see a color. Mm-hmm. And that color is not black. It's a brown color like everyone else once they get that tan. Okay. So when I study, you know, white people or Caucasian or whatever, I look at them. What is the problem with you? And how did you get to this point? But personally, I learned to protect myself because I know how you are. So therefore, I will not put myself in harm's way because I know who you are and what you are in the history of how you got to where you are today. Right. So that's my comment. But Brother Tim, I really agree with you on that end. Alfonso, you know, I heard it all, but I've lived it, still live it today, because I got cousins and relatives, because they were dark complected and they lived on the plantation. They got separated. I got a 98-year-old cousin right now. He can tell you the whole story behind that. Okay. So that's where I'm at. Once you know what you're dealing with and who you're dealing with, protect yourself by any means necessary.
What's up, Trey?
Okay. Thank you so much. Brother Bridges, you want to say something? We're getting ready to close out. We only got about 3 or 4 minutes. Any closing thoughts that you might have?
Yeah, just to say that I really enjoyed the program and listening, but we still, as a people, have to know as much as we possibly can about our enemy. And when I say our enemy, I'm talking about the people who oppress us and those whose feet are on the necks of black people. And we're doing no differently than what any great general would do in war, or no different from what Muhammad Ali would do before he fought George Foreman. They look at the films, they study the person they're going to fight against so they can know how to defeat them. So we have to know as much as we possibly can about Caucasian European people in order to defeat them. We can't stop studying them and their history and their literature and their works, the writings of Robert Louis Stevenson and Rudyard Kipling, and the writers like Rider Haggard, and the colonial literature that they put in the minds of black people all around the world, including on the plantations of America. We have to study that so that we can know who and what we're dealing with in the world today.
All right. With that, I say amen. Brother Alfonso, closing thoughts?
I say to that what my brother just dropped. I say, like I said, that's beautiful. I say.
Beautiful. Well, brothers and sisters, thank you so much, Asante Sana, to all of you. Have a wonderful week. Don't forget to listen to our program on Saturday, the Black Reality Think Tank Weekend Edition. Don't forget to listen to Brother Oshie's program tomorrow, that he deals with Pan-Africanism, which is clearly a suggested route for liberation. It would be ideal to listen to that and see what information that we can garner from them. We'll be back here next week, next Tuesday, same time, same place. Have a very safe and productive week.
No one remember old Marcus Garvey. 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 No one remember him. No one. They've been talking about Papoose. my bus, Yavi. Yes, 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 yes.